So my name's Jaylee. I am a sergeant for the Queensland Police Dog Squad. My role is a police dog instructor. I've been here for 10 years. So I've been 5 years as a handler and coming into my 6th year now as a training and development officer.
And what did you do before that?
So I was in general duty. So I started in the Queensland Police in 2008. And then once I graduated from being a recruit, I went out on the road for it was probably about 8 years, 8 to 9 years. I'm out there just doing general duties, did some relieving in cat crime and a few other areas. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, my goal was always to come to Dog Squad. But it was such a hard position to get that it was probably 7 years worth of applying applications, interviews to actually get a position as a handler. So when I came in, I was at the rank of senior constable. So okay. I said then I was a drug dog handler on the road there for 5 years in that role before being promoted to a sergeant and then taking on the police dog instructor role. So with that, we do all the training and development starting from puppies right through to courses, assessments, training, the whole lot.
So it's very difficult, I guess, to get into becoming a dog handler.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit about like what it's like to find to get into that position.
Yeah.
And then if you want, explain a little bit the difficulties it is because being female, that's, especially when you came in, that was obviously a different kind of time.
Yeah. So, you know, when you enter into the police, everyone says to you pretty much straight away, don't bother about applying for the dog squad because you'll never get there. Also, obviously, it is a male-dominated role. So there was another female in here, but it was a rarity for females to get in. So I guess it's not for the lighthearted. Like, you know, you can't give up. Everybody will tell you that you fail, that you'll fail, and you do fail. So I think I had about four applications. So with the Queensland Police to get into Dog Squad, it's you have to write a resume, and that includes a lot about what jobs you've done on the road, and there's a job description. So you have to fill that on the road to be able to come in here. There's the foster care program that you can get involved with the police. Again, that's sort of hard role. Once you put in your application, then there comes a short listing. So they'll only list. So there could be up to, I think the last job here, just for a handler in Brisbane, there was over 100 applications of police and there's only one position. So we'll normally shortlist two or three, sometimes five, depending on that. Then you have to go through a panel interview for a series of questions that they put about being a dog handler. Once you complete that, then you have to complete what we call is a PCA. So it's a physical component test. Then you get through that. Then you have to do psychometric testing after that, where you go through pretty similar testing to when you get into the police. And then after that, you complete. When I came through in 2014, I think it was, when I came here, it was a 14-week course back then. So you have to complete that. And then you go on the road and you do at least a 6-month mentor period with a senior handler. And then you pretty much kick off around the state by yourself. So in Brisbane, when I was in, there wasn't a lot of regional handlers either. So we've got places, one for about regional 14, 15 hours away from Brisbane. There wasn't a lot of that. So it really required, I was on the road a lot. So it was me and my dog driving to a deployment 15 hours away. And they could ring you at any day and go, hey, Jay, tomorrow you start work and you're going to go to Cairns. So you drive for 3 days. You deploy on warrants and then you drive back yourself. So it was a lot different then. Now we've kind of got regional handlers. There's not as many deployments. And at the time too, there was a lot of, in Australia, we did a lot with bikey crimes and things like that. So when I came in, there was busy, busy, busy because we were sort of cracking down on bikey laws and things like that. So I guess the times changed a lot for handlers and whatnot, but I don't think the competitiveness to get in has definitely not changed. I've had foster carers here with me for the last 6 years that have fostered dogs and still haven't been shortlisted for a spot. So,
wow.
Yeah.
How many times were you rejected before you finally got the chance to come in?
Four
times.
Yeah. And I made it sometimes to the interview. And then I would, you know, be so nervous that I would look at the questions and go, I knew that. But so when I failed twice on interview, I actually then went away and learned how to interview properly and learned to put myself in high-pressured situations with people just throwing questions at me because I knew that that was my weak spot. And then after I did that, I finally scraped through and got lucky. And then with being I enjoyed my journey on the road with working dogs. I had a bit of a bad start to probably why my journey in going into puppies came about was I had a dog that His name was Turbo, not the Turbo we have here now, another Turbo. And we bought him at 18 months old. And I was put through a course with him, but he had inflammatory bowel disease. Mm. So a lot of the time his drive was down and things like that. And he had, you know, really bad chronic stomach issues. He'd had bowel surgery and operations. So I, my first dog on the road, had all these medical issues, but was, you know, told to push along. And then at four, they ended up putting him down. So hence I had to then go along and get a new dog that we could have not had all those issues is if we'd known what his medical background was and why we were giving him in the first place, you know. So that was rough for me. And then I guess when he passed away, at just getting that dog and being on the road for 12 months, you're finally kicking off, and then all of a sudden you get to that 2 year in and your dog starts having, you know, lymphoma in his stomach, mm-hmm. and multiple bowel surgeries, you kind of, as a handler, you question yourself, like, is this me? Because my dog one day is so good and the next day he's like this. And no one knew how bad, like, his stomach was until we actually had to put him down. So my journey into it wasn't, there was a period of time, probably I think 3 years in, that I was like, I'm done. I'm going to go back on the road because of the emotional toll of learning and doing it. Yeah. And then it was probably after doing that and getting through that, and then I started to learn a lot about dogs and stuff in my own time. And then the role came up here for training and development and to run the courses. And I had some pretty good bosses here that were sort of encouraging towards me to do it. Uh-huh. And so I put in and ended up landing the spot as this and grew our program from coming in and doing some sitting down and pulling the whole program apart. And then going into our bosses and going, this is what we've got. Mm-hmm. And then hence the beginning of our journey.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So once you got into the dog squad, like you said, you had that first dog. After that dog passed away, I take it you got your second dog.
Yeah.
And what was the name of your second dog? And what did your second dog do?
So Minka, the dog I had in here before. So she saved me, to be honest. Like, they could see that my other dog wasn't well. So we were buying dogs off other agencies at that time. So they purchased my new dog, Minka, because Turbo had another bowel obstruction surgery. So they kind of were like, oh, well, let's get another dog, which meant I had to run on another course and get her up and running to do that. But I then sort of realized it was when I got her that was a really good and easy dog, has great ball drive, like naturally obedient, loves to search. That made me sort of go, I guess, realize that there was such differences between dogs, you know. And I said, and that's what kept me in there. And she saved me through my training journey as well, which we'll go into, but changing from, she was trained in our old methodologies of the, you know, throwing in the towel, popping them in a sit. She went through a 14-week course in that way. And then once I was on in the road with her for about 2 years when I took this position in training role, and I said, look, if I'm going to do some research into doing, you know, changing our methodologies, restructuring our programs, because she was an operational dog, you don't keep your operational dogs in a non-operation role, that they were allowed me to, I guess, use her as my guinea pig. So that started my journey on changing a dog in the old methodologies that was super dependent on me. I can see a lot of things that I did to then stripping her right back, you know, loading a marker, and then started to train her operantly, shaping her, walking out of the room while she was searching. I mean, I remember the first day that I did it, she sat at that door for 25 minutes looking out there going, where are you? You know, so I was lucky enough, and still to this day, you know, playing around with focus boxes and doing a little bit of e-collar stuff, trialing that in detection and seeing what worked and then what
didn't work.
And I think if I didn't have a dog, because I couldn't just go and change the whole system, mm-hmm. I had to prove to people and to handlers that there was a better way to do things, and there was no better way to show them as this dog was trained like your dog and remember her. To now she's searching. And a good example I did of that through marker training was she used to have a really bad issue with tennis balls. And I went into a warrant and they cleared the house and she's indicated under this bed. And I've come in and I'm like, God, there's got to be something in there. So I brought in the detectives and I was like, she's under this bed. And there was an offender under the bed throwing her tennis balls. And I was like, oh, this is really, and they're like, there's just a girl under the bed. She's like, yeah, every time I threw your dog a tennis ball, she'd come out. And she used to pick them up in search areas. So I showed a demonstration to the handlers of Minka with tennis balls everywhere, picking them up. and I marker trained her, and to the point that I had tubes on the ground with tennis balls and food, and I bounce a tennis ball and she would just completely ignore them through shaping and doing the marker training, the focus box and all that sort of thing. That's when the journey in some heads sort of started to change. It's like, hey, you know, we don't have to put up with our dogs eating in search areas, and you don't crank them and yell them and drag them out of the room. There's better ways to do that. So she's been our demo.
I was going to ask, so what was it that inspired you to make the change? Was it that particular incident, or was it just in general, you thought to yourself, there's got to be a different way to do it than the way I've been doing it?
I always put this to the handlers, and the way I put it to the bosses was, we don't do heart surgery like we did 10 years ago. We advance, we change, things get better. So since we started this journey in detection here, I think in 2000, and the course that we did, no one's done another course for 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
So our methodologies had never been. And then I think my journey of having a dog that wasn't well, and then seeing how I was trained, and then the old methods, and then I guess when I first got promoted too, I went to New Zealand to watch some dog games, and they were talking about markers over there. And I was like, what's a marker? And I actually said to another handler that was there, I was like, are they talking about markers? Are we talking about, like, is that when dogs wee on a tree? Are they marking? And he just looked at me like I was an idiot. And I was like, I was meant to be a judge there. And I was like, that's so embarrassing. So when I got back to Australia, I started watching trainers on YouTube and talking to other trainers. And it wasn't a well-known thing, marker training, in Australia at that time, or in the policing anyway. I'm sure dog sports and tricks and all those sorts of things were being done. But we just seem to have had this umbrella over our heads for 10 years where we're doing it right. And I'm not going to even bother about asking anybody else what they're doing. So I think me going and landing this job and then going to watch other dogs train and then seeing these little puppies over in New Zealand, they had puppies on little tubes finding odor. And I was like, okay, well, we're doing something wrong. So when I got back from New Zealand, one of our superintendents pulled me in. He's like, what did you see? And I said, this. And he's like, right, okay, well, what are we doing? You know, they're breeding puppies, they're finding odor at 12 weeks old, they're doing these great environmentals. They had a dog over there search a field, like a golf course, with tennis balls everywhere, and there was cocaine inside a tennis ball, and it indicated on the and that was enough for me to come back and go, my dog eats them in a search area. And I'm calling areas and calling detectives in going, oh, I found something, and then I find someone with a tennis ball under a bed. So it was kind of, I guess, embarrassment. It's my personality to go, what can we do better?
Yep.
And then just, I guess, falling on my feet and being open to learning and seeing that things can be done better.
How hard was it to, when you started learning yourself what markers were and just other training methodologies, how hard was it to bring it into a system that had already been established and individuals who had been training technically longer than you? How did you go about that, and what was that journey like?
It was difficult because I think change within this organization, or change for anyone, is difficult. And then trying to lead the way. So I guess I reached to people that were external, other trainers. So I had a network within people that I met in New Zealand. So New Zealand were wonderful to me in sharing their methodologies. The military, there were some guys, Marco, Black Roll Canine, they came over and showed me some stuff. And then a lot of YouTube and a lot of researching myself. I listened to a lot of Pat Stewart. I went to a few seminars of his as well. So I started learning more about marking and shaping that sort of way. And then what I did was, I got New Zealand's way of that, because obviously there was a little bit of difference between the military and there was a lot of difference between policing. Like, we've got different search areas. They were using Malinois, God, even me bringing even a shepherd into detection. It was Labradors only.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, you can see we're branching out. So I guess for me, it was having external relationships through people that supported me. So I used to have like a little WhatsApp with multiple trainers in there, some from Border Force Australia, Northern Territory Police, CATH VicPol. So we all had like a little WhatsApp group, and we would share videos of those sorts of things. So every time a handler would give me pushback or they would question me, if I wasn't confident, I had a group that I could go to and say, what do you guys reckon? How can we answer this? But you've got to have thick skin. Like, there was some as there were some people that just really didn't want to change and didn't want to look at it. But I'd say now, after 6 years, we've had a massive turnaround. Like, everybody has come on board to sort of see it, and they're all getting out new dogs, even though they still call it the new system.
Yeah.
Marker training 6 years on, we're still the new system versus the old throwaways and things like that. So it was hard. It was not easy. Adverse. Yeah. Had a few sleepless nights. And then Pat, when COVID hit, Pat, our other trainer, it kind of just worked out for me. He came on because Pipes and Drums shut down, and I told you he'd been around here for 15 years, but no one tapped into that knowledge. And
sure.
So the bosses were like, well, Pat, you have to stay with Jay for 2 years while COVID's on. And that's when we really got a flow on. So when I first started here too, we had no training facilities. These sheds weren't here.
Oh, wow.
So I had nothing. I had a trailer and a drug bunker. And we could sometimes use the academy. So that was another challenge for me. So we got some funding that we had these sheds built. So when, you know, we started writing reports as to how dogs don't understand context, so we need shaping rooms and odor room. We didn't even have a scent wall.
Wow.
I didn't even know what a scent wall was.
Yeah.
You know, so I got the funding to have these sheds built and started, you know, doing that. I even had people come down and be like, what do we need a shed for? I was like, in time you'll see.
Yeah.
You know, just follow the path and hopefully we'll get there. But then, yeah, that was a really big turning point for me to have somebody come in, because I was in charge of the whole entire state, which, wow, you know, Ben spoke to you about before. So not only, so our general purpose program here has puppy development officers. So they do all the breeding and they do the development, and then they have the staff that run the courses and then they do the assessments. Well, my job was all of that.
Wow.
You know, all the development, but we were buying dogs at that time as well. So we didn't need to do puppy development.
Sure.
But then I was like, hang on, let's get puppies, even though we didn't have any development mm-hmm. officers at that time. So, yeah.
What would you say before you became the trainer that you are now, back when you were working a dog, what was something, either one of the biggest lessons you learned or something that stood out that formed you to be better as a trainer, but it was lessons learned as a handler or deployments that you went through that helped you go, okay, this lesson is something I'm going to try to share and teach others when I get into that training position?
Probably the biggest thing is it was to change the culture of don't hide your dog and the mistakes, and don't come out. And, you know, if your dog's not working, then when I wasn't in training and I was a handler, you didn't want to speak up. You're just like, oh, this isn't working. So, and feeling nervous and feeling like I couldn't have anyone to turn to, and then realizing that you can't teach people when they're nervous and they're scared, and you can't have your blinkers on and think you're the best that there is and not listen to other people and have a, you know, multiple people coming in like yourself, like you guys, and just continual learning was probably the biggest thing that I've learned. Is you don't just develop a system, which mm-hmm. we have now. Mm-hmm. And I'm not closed off to thinking, well, you know what, this is working pretty well, I'm not going to listen to anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
And probably operationally, the thing that I saw helps us the most is get out of the dog's face. Let the dog do the job. You don't need to run around touching everything. Mm-hmm. You don't need to show the dog where everything is. And sometimes let the dog fail.
Yeah.
We had this mentality here that the dog didn't find it, just go in and show them. So I guess through my training or being an operational handler, if someone had just told me to stand at the door and let my dog work, versus run around and, you know, show the dog where everything is, would have changed my confidence in the dog
mm-hmm.
because I never trusted my dog, because I would just show him and he would just sit, or I would, you know, said he wasn't well as well, or is that a tennis ball under the bed, or is it odor? You know, so I think through learning new methodologies and changing over to the marker system, or for us personally, like teaching our dogs to be more operant and letting them discover odor themselves versus showing them where it is and telling them when they're wrong, when they sit on a control, no, and taking them out. That's when my world changed for me in deer detection. Yeah.
So like you said, when you started here, it was you guys purchased dogs that were, I guess, older.
Yes.
And then either had some training or you added the training. I guess there's probably a little bit of both happening. Is that correct?
So we had a breeding program, I think, prior to me coming in. So I think it was around about 2000 we started one. So we did used to breed labs. But as you would know, if you don't have people to develop them and train them, so we would breed them, mm-hmm. and then we have a foster care program here. So they just go out to either police or members within the community. but we wouldn't see them. They were coming back for course. So the amount of money that we were putting into breeding and then all these dogs failing because they were coming back 40 kilos overweight with no development, the bosses sort of looked over it and went, that's not conducive.
Sure.
Whereas the GP program have development officers and a whole breeding team and that just do that. So when I came in, that's when I was the first course that we purchased. We just flew down to an external agency. We picked 8 dogs 2 weeks prior to course. Mm-hmm. We got their medical records and we would come back and day one, they would be like, here's your dog. And we're going to start developing them with the 14-week course with minimal development, depending on what the other agency had done. But we know that we were only getting their B-grade dogs or they would keep their A-grade dogs like anybody would. So that breeding program was shut down to do that. And I said, I don't know when I took over, I worked out that we were spending over $100,000 a year on purchasing dogs with a 50% success rate.
Yeah.
You know, and I was like, we could probably do that better. So I was able to source some breeders. So they wouldn't let me start a breeding program.
Yep.
But the bosses sort of were, okay, well, can you demonstrate to us where this would be cost effective and how we can. I said, well, what about with our new methodologies and puppy development and bringing them in 8 weeks that we're only spending, you know, maybe $30,000 or $20,000 on puppies, but now our success rate's gone up to like 95%. I think in the period of time, it's been 5 years since we started and we got better and better. You know, the C litter, we're now at like, I don't know, the M or the N litter, Nigel.
Yeah.
So we've gotten better with our development as well. So as our dogs are, each time we did a course, we would just change little bit. And I think the biggest lesson that I learned out of puppies was less is best.
Mm-hmm.
We were like smashing the first 2 litters, like we've got to get them on odor. We've got to get them to do this. We've got to get them to do that. And now our approach is just get them load a marker and get those enviros done for 6 months and let a dog be a dog, you know.
Yep.
So now we're doing that. We're seeing – and we because we have the puppies from 8 weeks old, you really get to know their personality. So you can go, he's not going to be ready for that or she's not going to be ready or this dog's way faster at this and that. So we don't actually have a course that I run from week 1 to 10. I do, but we run it for the dog.
Yeah.
And that will change depending on what that dog needs, which is why I think we don't just reward with a ball or if that dog doesn't get through in 10 weeks, we don't go, oh, well, you're sacked. We go, okay, he's going to sit here for 6 months because he's just got to learn this and work on that. So is it better to buy dogs and, you know, when you start to see errors at halfway through course, get rid of them straight away? Or was it better to go, oh, well, this dog's not working, let's put him on the next course? I said, and I think in 5 years we've had 2 dogs that we haven't put through, and one was for skin allergies.
Okay.
And one had some disjointed development between us and explosive dogs. They were going to take the dog, we were going to take the dog. So it didn't get developed properly.
Gotcha.
And his drive wasn't quite there. So I would say, apart from that, we haven't lost any dogs.
And that's a really good number because I'll start off with this. What you guys learned was, hey, we're not going to breed ourselves right now.
Yeah.
We're going to go to breeders, select puppies that we like from them, put them into our foster program, let them develop as puppies for most of that first 6 months of their life, doing some training.
Yes.
That foster program includes people who eventually want to become canine handlers. So 100%. You're doing 2 things at once.
100%.
You're building
their
future
resumes.
Knowledge. Yeah. Their resumes, their knowledge, getting the puppies developed.
Yeah.
By doing more natural things versus a regimented system of this is what they have to be by week, whatever.
100%.
And through that, you've had good success doing this kind of program, just as your GP program.
Yep.
And for those that are watching, listening, GP means general purpose. That's the bite dogs, tracking dogs, looking for people kind of thing. And they had success doing things very similarly.
Yes.
And because the common thing that we run into in the United States is, oh, I don't, in the law enforcement side, we don't ever want to do puppies because it's too much of a gamble. We might lose something. And even dog vendors in the United States, it's changing very little, but the mentality is still the same. I don't want to go puppies because the what if factor, the risk. But you guys, and as I've traveled the world now, seeing other agencies in Europe do the same thing as you guys.
Yeah.
Finding breeders, getting the puppies, developing them this way has turned out to be a far more effective way. And it really reduces the washout rate.
Massively. But you also, week 1 for us on course, the dogs are already finding a base odor. Mm-hmm. They've already searched a room. They're already searching cars, and they may have done some basic external, depending on what that the capability that we roll out. So, you know, I find that when we're coming on course, we can spend more time focusing on what the handler needs rather than trying to join them together as a team. We also have a very good idea about the personality and the type of dog that that handler may need, because you know that certain dogs won't suit certain handlers. Mm-hmm. Certain handlers will particularly want a more robust dog. Some dogs need more, you know, their play drive might be more about, you know, the engagement versus some that just want to play with the toy. So we go in our head in advance, knowing, I think we've got 43 detection dogs statewide. Mm-hmm. As they're rolling in, we know what handlers we're replacing. So we go, that dog's going to be good for that person. So that's when we started. We used to only have Labradors.
Okay.
But that's when we started to go, we breed shepherds here. Mm-hmm. And we don't use them all for biting and tracking. Sometimes we might breed a litter of 9.
Yeah.
And there'll be 6 left over. So now I go down, I was like, let's try shepherds.
Yep.
You know, so then there was that change that had to come mm-hmm. in. The handlers, we can't work shepherds, because here in Australia, you don't see shepherds searching people. So we had to fight that mentality then. So that little change again. So now we're going from marker system and food rewarding and toy rewarding and puppies. So the other thing you get a little bit is handlers or staff will look at it and they can see this new puppy coming in and they're like, is that me? Is that mine? You know, and sometimes that's a really good thing, because you might give some of the handlers will want to take a dog on in the foster care, you know, take it on themselves. And if they've got the time to do it and they start bonding with that dog, and even if they don't have the time all the time, we go, oh, this dog could potentially be yours in the future, or out of these 3. Mm-hmm. So you see that investment from the handlers come down to our training and go, who's running today?
Yeah.
So they automatically get that starting to like for these 3 dogs. So you can kind of start to blend them together. And I think that's a big thing. But what we also just started doing is, when we know a course is coming up, like we're doing human remains soon, mm-hmm. cadaver dogs, we have given those dogs, so they're already doing searches, basic searches. They've been with us, they're 14 months old. We're ready to put them on a course. So we've sent them to their handlers for 2 to 3 months. We still say, come in here and we do one or two training runs with them. We say, don't deploy them, don't train them, just bond with them.
Mm-hmm.
So you see them up in the obstacle yard throwing a ball. And so by the time they come on course, this dog's moved away from us and it's now bonded with the handler. That's even when you can just really pretty much sit back on a course and go, this is done. Like the work's done.
Yeah.
You're not sitting down designing runs every night to fix the issues. You've got more time to spend on the handler teams.
Yeah.
And then you can say to them, what do you want to work on? What do you and that dog want? So they feel like they're more invested in the training. They're not just being told, get your dog out, you're running on this today. By the time we get to, you know, we run a 8 to 10 week course. Mm-hmm. But like I said, we've already probably put a decent amount of hours into them. It's very
I think we were talking, it was almost 8 to 10 months of time has already been invested.
Yeah, from 8 weeks right through to 12 months. But what we also found was really, instead of having block training days where we just had 3 days, we will bring dogs in for 2 or 3 weeks and spend time with them and get them searching for their basic odor or imprint them. And then we send them home to their foster carers and we say, for the next 2-3 months, just mm-hmm. let them be a dog. Mm-hmm. Take them for a walk. Continue mm-hmm. with their enviros. And then we find that they come back after having a break and they're even better.
Yeah.
Rather than every week for 14 weeks, 1 million toys a day, 1 million towels a day, you know, we can space out their training so they view this as fun, not like, oh, it's another day.
Yeah.
So we saw that the dogs doing this by having large block trainings, but more time in between their training, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it matches the research that we see nowadays, which is it's quality over the quantity.
100%.
And the other thing too, you're bringing up, I'll ask this real quick before I carry on. How old is the average age when you start the formalized training?
We don't like to put them on course any earlier than 15 months.
Perfect. So you're at a year and a half, let's just say. So we've gone through the maturity aspects.
Yes.
We've gone through those ups and downs of a young dog.
Yes.
And again, one of the things that I see frequently in the United States is, and this is with dual purpose dogs on top of it all, they're getting dogs as young as 10 months to 12 months old and putting them through a 6-week course, maybe 8-week course for dual purpose. So the fact that you're even on single purpose, not even starting until 15 months old. But the amazing things I loved listening to was you know the dogs.
Yeah.
You know all these little things about them.
We know which one likes a ball. We know which one likes a Kong. We know which one's food driven.
And that must help you also identify which detection discipline you might put a dog into. Yeah.
And then we look at the breed as well, you know, so we'll go, oh, well, we're using Springer Spaniels for cadaver and blood work, you know, a lot of the time because of the type of search areas that we have. And then bringing in the German Shepherds into the detection program and then a Malinois Shepherd, which was just unheard of, you know, which, again, helped us a lot to learn about the development of the dogs. Mm-hmm. Don't develop a Labrador like we were developing the Spaniels versus the Shepherds, you know, and the food drive and the Labbies are way better and the Shepherds like their tug toys better or whatever. So that helps us, again, go, well, that's good for that discipline.
Yeah.
So we will now bring in our first German Shorthead Pointer and Widehead Pointer as well for that too. So, yeah, I guess trialing different dogs for different capabilities, being able to be diverse in what reward systems we use. You know, I think that was a big learning point for me too, learning about, you know, not the variation to reward, direct and indirect rewarding, like blending all of that together, combining food in, all that stuff that we spoke about, and then bringing in different breeds. If someone told me that we was going to do that 6 years ago, I probably would have laughed.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
No, it's, I mean, just because of that, one, the investment in the time, knowing the dog, you're now able to invest in the handler.
Yes.
And again, the prior investment of some of these handlers already being a foster care aspect, going through that rigorous application process.
They're excited to come in.
Yeah. They're bought in. And then, but instead of trying to train the dog and the human at the same time, the dog already has a pretty good investment in training.
Yes.
You're now able to focus on the handler skills, get those good.
Yep.
And then the team's, again, building together.
Yeah.
But that's such a, it's a great concept to see how well when you invest in the time. And I get a lot of programs, it's hard for them to do that.
Yeah.
But you're showing it works, which is really cool.
You need to, I think the biggest thing, if someone could have spoken to me, was it's not going to happen overnight. It's taken us 6 years and now we're even to the point where, so say people worried about puppies and one of them not passing, that question gets asked to us. And it might be that you get a bad batch of puppies. I don't know. Like I'm yet that question's asked of me. So I guess to mitigate that, what we've done now is we've got a couple of extra puppies because we've done that over time. And because our success rate's been so high, we've got a few dogs that we don't need right now.
Yeah.
So I get them through a course and I know they've still got a bit of work to do. Then we've got experienced handlers out on the road and they don't have a second dog. I'll say to the bosses, can for 18 months or a year, I don't need this dog, but it's 13 months, it's gotten through a course.
Mm-hmm.
So the operation of handlers, I do a reteam with them and then they take that dog out on the road. So
nice.
If I'm getting brand new handlers in from that are going to go to regional areas by themselves, I'm able to pull in a dog from the road that's now new with 18 months experience and put that dog with a brand new handler going.
Yeah.
So that dog's got 18 months experience.
Yeah.
So now we're not seeing as much stress in new handlers because I go, well, we've got this dog. This dog's been here. And then if I happen to get a bad batch of puppies, it's taken me 5 years, but now we've got some leftover dogs.
Yeah.
So now I've got dogs. So if someone said to me tomorrow, we need a drug dog, I can literally go, there's two on the road.
Yeah.
They're spare
right
now. So that was always my goal was, there was no such thing around here as a spare dog.
Mm-hmm.
Now we've got that spare dog. Now I feel like the pressure comes off your shoulders with your puppy development because if you two fail, doesn't matter.
Yeah.
But you've got to put the time and the investment and you it'll buy a couple of extra ones and get, I think with development too, if you don't have the team, you won't work.
Yeah.
You need to have puppy development offices or a program that's structured. So what we do is we get the puppies, like we've got new ones at the moment. We've got trusted foster carers.
Yep.
We let them settle for a couple of weeks with their new carers. We bring them in, we load the markers and we just teach the foster carers. A lot of them have been with us. So they know they need to go on buses and trains and they'll go and do all that work for us because we don't have time.
Yeah.
And then we bring them back in and we'll say, okay, now we're going to teach them toy searching. But what they also do for us is they keep a record. So we have a log on teams that each handler can get into. And in that log for each dog, it has all their medical stuff.
Oh, wow.
They put in where they worm them, any medical issues they've had, when they're born, all their numbers, everything like that. And then we have an instructor's log that's locked down. Only the instructors can get to that. And then for the foster carers, they can log in through teams and it has a sheet. And every day they write what went through the markets, dog failing at this, dogs scared of slippery floors. So once a fortnight, we'll sit down as a development team and we'll log into there and we'll have a look at what dogs are doing what. And we also have the each handler or each foster carer knows that they have our contact point. We're on call 24/7.
Yep.
So if a dog gets bitten by a snake or they're really worried, sometimes I'll ring and they'll go, oh, my dog started this behavior. And if you give them the, I guess, your time and say, I don't care what time it is. Yeah. I don't care what, just ring me. I don't even care if it's a training issue. The dog's scratching at the back door. The dog started barking at this. I'd rather you call me and ask.
Yeah.
And so we can fix that right now than let it go for 3 months or 4 months and then me have this issue. Like if it's scared of cars, tell me.
Yeah.
If it's scared of slippery floors, tell me. Yeah. So that way we can constantly review our logs. Mm-hmm. So if someone comes to me and says, you know, this dog's been on the road for 3 years and now it's got this issue, we can pull up our logs and we video our course every single day, gets videoed and documented. So we now have all their training and development from day one, right through from imprinting all the way through to the day we go on the road. We say to the handler, there's the training and development. This is the issues we saw with the dog when it was younger. He's going to need a little bit more work in this.
Sure.
This dog's really strong at that. So go and focus on this, because we know that you can't give the same training program to every handler that leaves, because not every dog needs that.
Correct.
So we concentrate on giving them. And then when you've got a new handler that's got two dogs and they're completely different, you go, you can't set up the same training for both these dogs. That's not going to work.
Yeah.
So we can give them, able to give them a better idea of how can we go away and train this better? How can you focus on that dog's strength and weaknesses?
Yeah.
So that really helps.
It's investing. I mean, you guys are truly investing in the program.
Yeah.
And it has this payoffs, obviously, because your teams are solid. They have a better, when they actually go on the road, dog and handler at a higher level of proficiency than just being two new beings, a dog and a human, trying to figure this out.
Yes.
And having the support structure that you guys have with your training center, even if there is something that comes up, they can quickly reach out to you guys and it's there.
Yeah.
It's really refreshing to see that. Now, with your detection program, what different disciplines of detection do you guys train?
So we have our biggest one is you guys call it narcotics, we call it drugs.
Yep.
So we have drug detection teams. We normally imprint them. So this was another interesting thing that I found when I took over our training was our biggest drug issue here is meth. When I took over the training, we didn't even have meth in our bunker. So we weren't even training on what we found the most on the road. So that was another thing we went and I did. I was like, we need an extra bunker in here. And can we actually get some meth to start imprinting our dogs on it? Because we would actually just go and teach them that on the road.
Oh, wow.
We'd have a dog going on the road trying to find meth, which is 90% of our finds, but it's never been trained on it. So we would just get street gear from a bunker, from a property point, and go and run your dog on it. In, like I said, put it down in a room. No controls, no nothing, and just put your dog in a seat and throw a towel in and go, now my dog's on meth. No one signed it off. No one did anything. So that was another thing, that another training issue that we had. Now we have meth, but, you know, the turnover of getting new stuff in is still a little bit difficult. But, yeah, there's something I've said when I went off on a side path. I think about that. I'm like, I remember that. I was going, why, we don't even have meth. Like, someone get that for me. Sorry, what were we talking about?
So what are the other disciplines besides the drugs?
We have the drugs. Mm-hmm. We normally imprint here, so meth. Heroin, ecstasy, MDMA, and cocaine.
Okay.
So we will start on that. And so it depends on what our dogs are going to do. We call people passive searching here. If the dogs, half of the dogs here will search people, so big dance parties and things like that. We don't do airports, the police, we leave that to customs and AFP, but we will do that. And so if those dogs might also have firearms on them as well, because a lot of our warrants here, we'll want what comes hand in hand, cash, drugs, and firearms.
Yeah.
But we don't put cash on our passive dogs. So those dogs that are searching people don't find cash because everybody carries cash. So we're going to be indicating on cash. So that's our big thing over here. But they'll still have firearms on them, but all the police have firearms on them, and they don't, as we know, they don't indicate on them
because
they know
they're there. Thing, yeah. Right? Yeah.
Yep. So then there's always that, do we train them to find one that's just sitting on something, or then they're going to indicate on the big ones hanging off our hips? We haven't really gone into that, but they tend to work through it quite well. And we have, I think, 4 cadaver dogs here. I think it's us and New South Wales Police are the only 2 states that have them. We go and help in a lot of other states with them. So we've got an a HRD course coming up now. We tend to use Springer Spaniels in that area. We have had some Shepherds in it, but they don't tend to be as good going through those heavy, dense bush areas. They got good noses, but we were like, they're not working anywhere near as well as the Spaniels that you can just see the bush moving. And they're just completely. So
they're in their element.
Yeah,
sure.
And then we have, I think, 2 blood dogs we have there. And not last year, the year before, we put out our first technology dog, which we're doing a second one for. Now, we have explosive dogs here, but they're not part of this unit. They're part of another unit. They do all their own training and development. I think we have 7 dogs over there. So what's that? Cash, drugs, firearms, explosives, human remains, blood, and technology.
Yeah. That's a robust detection dog program.
Yeah.
I was curious. I just wanted to, you know, and you had told me before we recorded this, but so the blood part, what's been the challenge even in training with that and maintaining that? What's something that you've seen? I know we're talking about like even things to work on.
Yeah. So we got our dogs trained. I think it was New South Wales Police originally that helped us with the blood dogs. We've got 2 out there now, but we have 2 Springer Spaniels in our system that have gone through our development. So we'll be looking at running a new course. I think our biggest challenge out there was letting the police know we had them.
Yeah.
So, but then if you advertise too much, then you've only got 2 dogs and then you get 100 requests. So that was, I guess, is constantly letting detectives and police know that this is a capability that we have. And we've proved we're pretty successful with it when we do actually deploy.
So they get some decent amount of work?
Yeah, definitely. And the boys and girls have had some good finds and help out a lot for different sort of stuff with homicide. And I think we had one just recently as we're getting better now with it. What we found helps is, because we're based on the back of our police academy, we started going down to the detective training phase because they all come through here and do their training. So they love that. Yeah. So every time, because we bring a puppy down and everyone's like, oh, puppies, you know, and then we go, hey, we've got blood dogs, we've got cadaver dogs. And because they're the main units that are going to eventually, you know, all our specialist units, whether they're there for homicide or like I said, child protection. The other day, we kind of had a laugh because we had Rocky, our new technology dog down there in the child protection unit. And they're like, is that another CEM dog, you know, which are the technology dogs.
Yep.
So, but then you push too hard and then we get too many requests. So it's just that fun. That balance and saying sometimes we get jobs back. Our human remains dogs get used quite a bit because we help other agencies as well. But the blood dogs is something that just is sort of like slow and steady. We'll get an influx of jobs and then it goes a little bit quiet. Mm-hmm. And so we've got, as I said, 2 of them. Whether we could get more, we probably could. Mm-hmm. But then do we have too many?
Yeah.
Like, that's always that juggling act. It's like development. That's another issue we have is, you got to have that balance of not too many dogs ready and then not enough ready.
Yep.
So it's the same in the operational world. You always feel like you've got too much or not enough. You're constantly balancing for it.
No, it for sure. The other unique part I wanted to add before we wrap it up is just like we were talking about how first training has evolved, but what we both agreed on and what we've seen is the unique aspect as more women have entered into the training aspect, there's also been a shift in how information is shared and collaboration. Mm. What's been your experience now? Because as I've traveled around Australia, the head of the New South Wales prison system dog program is a woman.
Yes.
The one we just met this week, Sarah from the Air Force, women. Cat over at VicPol, women.
Yeah.
So I'm just super curious from your point of view. I know what I see, but I would love to see from your point of view, what's that been like with the change? Because you've been in it long enough. You've seen what the old way was and then what's been going on since more and more women have entered the training aspects.
It's been interesting for me, like coming into that space because I didn't really know a lot of female trainers. But when I did come into this role, as I started to sort of branch out, I realized that there were quite a few females. And I find that they're all pretty generous in sharing information. I don't feel like there's ever any, this is ours, this is yours. So dealing with females has been good, like pleasurable. I feel like there's no, this is our secret.
Yeah.
I also feel like with them, but I must say, like, I've worked with some great males as well.
Of course.
You know, of that, that's come through as well, that want to share their knowledge. So I think maybe it's just that most of these areas are always seen as very male dominated.
Mm-hmm.
And now maybe we're just seeing that change in more females coming through, the you know, that we're all, I don't know whether it's just an influx that happened all of a sudden, or whether it's, you know, I don't know what it is.
What caused it.
But I find, that's what helped me get through in the beginning.
Yeah.
You know, it was having, you know, Megan from Border Force. Mm-hmm. She's a big mm-hmm. one down there in Melbourne. They're their biggest detection company, you know, biggest detection in Australia. She's one of the, mm-hmm. you know, the leaders down there. So
yeah, I've met her. She's great.
You know, So when we changed our program first, Megan kind of was like, knocked on my door and was mm-hmm. like, hey, what's that stuff you're doing?
Yeah.
I was helping Megan on a WhatsApp group, and along with Ty from Northern Territory, he's not there now, mm-hmm. is the three of us. You know, Ty would help me, and then I started learning stuff about the focus box. And so the three of us mm-hmm. really together was not secretly, but we were training Megan.
You were testing
on the
things
side.
Out. Yeah.
Like, I can't go and show everybody that's been here, you know, we're the biggest detection in Australia. I can't just go in there and start saying yes and because we learned from them.
Yeah.
So when we learned, I was kind of a little bit like, this is weird. I had never did a Border Forces course or the way that the old methodologies, but here we are 6 years later with me and Megan training them to do what they taught us to do. And, you know, so it was like this big round circle of doing that. So it was interesting. It just seems, I don't think even it's necessarily just a female thing, but when you're changing things, you don't want to be doing it in front of people. You want to do it behind closed doors, and it's like anything, you want to nail it and get it right, because the first time everybody sees it, you got to get it right. So yeah, I think working with people that are, I'd say the people that are open-minded make good trainers. Like I said to you earlier today, we've got a really good system, and if I can share our system with as many people as we can, then that's awesome, because I can then pick up little bits and pieces, like what you guys told us this week already in our program. We're like, yeah, we need to do more of that. We need to do more of this. I think that's what makes you a good trainer. Mm-hmm. That's what's evolving. But I know that, and I don't know if it's, I think it's a policing thing. Is change.
Oh, it's so tough. It's
like,
so tough.
We don't do it that way.
No.
You know, mm-hmm. we just don't. I mean, the littlest things that we get told to change, and it's not just dog training, it's just in general, seems to be really like it's the biggest thing in the world. And that might be something like, I remember when we had to start wearing our lanyards for a while with our IDs on them everywhere. It was like the biggest catastrophe ever. It was like, you know, like a hurricane had just hit us. I was like, it's just a lanyard.
Yeah.
You know, we change over the type of car we get. We go from Amarok's to Ford's. It's like, I don't want to drive a Ford. It's like, so what chance have we got in dog training?
I know,
that's what,
right?
I always say to people.
Yep.
You know, but I said, my classic line is to people that don't want to change in dog training or in anything is literally, we don't do heart surgery the way we did 10 years ago. We don't open the heart up, and we don't cut you open anymore. We probably do it with a little machine this big and do it. So why don't we advance anywhere else?
Yeah.
You know?
No, for sure.
And that seems to people kind of, when I say that to people, they kind of look at me like, she's right. And you can kind of see their brain sort of tick over a little bit more and think. Mm. But the other thing we were talking about is, I think you have to show people. You can't tell them.
For sure.
Because when they see, and then the people that don't want to change, I always just say, go get your dog and show me then. Because if you can show me a better way, I'll do it.
For sure.
Every day of the week.
Absolutely. I mean, because there's so much with social media, there's a lot of talk.
Yes.
And social media only shows the good stuff.
Yeah.
But let me see what it is you're talking about. Demonstrate it for me, just as I will when you want to see what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
I'm happy to get my dogs out and go do it.
Yeah.
Because it's the proof's there.
Yeah.
We can say anything we want, but I want to see it work. And then why does it work? And then there's more conversation that comes from that.
Yeah. And the more you discover with it, and the more you share, and the more you stay open-minded. But I also think the more dogs you get your hands on.
Yes.
You can do course after course after course. I learned this the hard way. I was, you know, on holidays downloading like a million podcasts for every trainer that I'd ever heard of, you know, on my holidays, listening to different ways I could do things. And I had this head full of knowledge that I could speak. And then I got my first hand on my dog and I tried to, I remember loading a marker and they're like, you just say yes and give it food. And then, so I did this with a fully grown lab and I said yes. And she sniffed the food and walked away. And I was like, I can't even load a marker. So she taught me a really valuable lesson from day one. You can think that you just know all this stuff in your head, but go and train dogs.
Yes.
And then see that, see the problems, that they're not all the same.
Yep.
I literally sat on the floor and loaded that dog's marker with a towel, going, yes, throwing a towel, yes, throwing a towel. And then finally her marker was loaded because she had zero food drive.
Yeah.
I said, see, that was another moment where I was like, I am not a rock star at this. I've got a long way to go.
Yeah. So over the past few days that we were here, what was something that you as a trainer are going to take away, or that you took away from what you went through?
Like as in what your training gave to us? Yeah, I think make it harder. We even us as training cell, we're so busy with time and we're restricted to time. But with our program, it's hard not to plateau. Is because we kind of have a conveyor belt now. Like we finally, after 6 years, have got our foot. Pat and I are like not running 30,000 steps a day and running dogs. And so you can become a bit complacent and think, that's all right, we got this, you know. But instead of thinking that, for me, is all the things that you said, is there will be a time when our methodologies get questioned. There will be a time that we need to make things, improve things of the things that you told us today. Our hides need to be better. You know, I think the biggest thing that I saw for the handlers, it was them coming out and listening to what you said. And actually, I didn't hear anyone go, like, oh, I'm not doing this. Mm-hmm. You know, that was massive for me to see with them.
Sure.
Is for you guys to come in and everybody to turn up. Because if that was 5 years ago, they all would have sat there and gone, who's this guy? Mm-hmm. The fact that they were open to listening to you and taking away the things that you told them and pressuring them. I said to them, what did Cameron do for us? Is it's now time to make things really hard for you guys. So you're probably going to wish that you didn't get him, because your assessments are going to be really difficult. You know, double blinds, all those things that we don't do, which we should spend more time now on, because we've got our courses down really well, is where I'll go and focus on is spending more time with our handlers for assessments. So it used to be like, let's just get the assessments done so we can put a tick in the box. Whereas now I feel like it should be more like a week's worth of assessments and testing them and odor recognition and doing that sort of thing, rather than these guys have got it. And I think what you brought to them the most was to show them that when you get a dog off us, you know, we're giving you the basic. Mm-hmm. We're giving you the model with no air conditioning, no power windows. Mm-hmm. You go put all the extra bells and whistles on it and then come back to us and tell us what you've done so we can make your assessments harder for you. So we can try and break you here and not break you out there.
Yeah.
I think that's probably the biggest thing that they took, and the biggest thing for us was we need to test them harder. We need to push them and not let them win. You can see here that mentality, it's difficult for them to not let their dog win. I don't know if that's a handler thing or something we all do.
It's everywhere.
Is it?
Yeah.
Because it's like, even us in our development now, after listening to a few of your podcasts and other stuff that you've said, is sometimes we'll put a hide down for a pup and you still want to walk and kind of be like, oh, you know, I want to guide that. Whereas now we're going to set up training, the other trainers I were talking about, two of us setting it up, and then the person running the dog has no idea where it is, even as trainers.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, even maybe doing that in just me with the dog in the room and not knowing where it is, even as a puppy, you know, once we've shaped it and we've got it to that ability, is because that's going to be more real to life for the dog, for us. So we could probably start that in our development. And if the dog fails, then we're not going to put a dog that needs, you know, we're in the teaching phase, so it needs 100% rewards. We're talking about once they get to sort of 12 months where they've been doing good searches for us. Mm-hmm. So maybe it's time now to start to bring that into the dogs prior to going on course, so they're not shocked when it happens, you know. So that sort of stuff for us.
What would you say, what's your opinion now about odor versus indication?
I have been with you on that journey for a long time, because I teach indication last. I don't care about it.
Mm-hmm.
The dog used to be indicating and its ear would move and it's like, no, drag the dog out, and the dog's done 99% right.
Mm-hmm.
So I say to people all the time now, if the dog finds the odor, it gives you a standoff and a big change of behavior and it stands on one foot and puts its paw up, I don't care.
Yeah.
you, because we were so fixated on that. So what I, when we first in our development program, when we were shaping the puppies, we used to get them to indicate quite quickly.
Yep.
Whereas now I teach them to search and then I get them up to discrimination really quickly, just holding their nose on odor. And it's almost now I let the dog dictate to me what the indication is going to be. Because mm-hmm. some dogs are naturally prone. Mm-hmm. I find the shepherds will go down.
Yeah.
Some dogs, we got stare response dogs. That nearly killed them
up
there.
You got a new pointer.
And so when we did our first, our stare response dog with the Malinois, because mm-hmm. she was really good at that, they were like, the dog's not sitting. I was like, no, but it's staring
mm-hmm.
and it's staring for a minute. Like, mm-hmm. what more do you want?
Yeah.
You know? And so we moved away. We won't even bother about teaching the indication till we've got full discrimination on multiple puppy tubes. Mm-hmm. We're making noises. We're walking around them. And I was saying earlier, we go away and if it's a sit, I free shape them to sit on a treat and train machine. I don't even tell them to sit.
Yeah.
We go into another room. Dog sort of plays on the treat and train, offers a sit, the biscuit comes out. You do three or four sessions to that,
mm-hmm.
go back into the shaping room, and the dog almost just offers you the sit response from you teach it away. And I teach it away from odor.
Yep.
I never teach it on odor. I never stuff around with the indication and I don't fix my problems on odor.
Because if a mistake happens, now you've got odor included into
100%.
It. 100%. Yep.
So if the dog's indication starts to get messy, it fails, or it's moving around, then we go back to focus drills or other drills mm-hmm. away from odor,
mm-hmm.
and then we come back to odor, and then mm-hmm. we reconnect it again. It's not something that, you know, same with surface issues. Dogs don't want it. We used to go, oh, the dog's scared of a slippery floor, so let's put 100 grams of cocaine on it.
Right.
Let the dog slide on the floor because it's going to want to go to the cocaine. Not now.
Mm-mm.
So now we will go and work with a marker and do environmentals away from odor for a period of time, then get the dog over that and then bring it back to the odor to try mm-hmm. and fix it there. That was big lessons we learned back in the old school days. Was the same with, I guess, we used to always tell them when they were wrong as well. So sitting on a control. And we'd be like, no, and then we'd take them out. So then you know operationally they're sitting there going, are you going to tell me I'm right?
Mm-hmm.
Or are you going to tell me I'm sitting on a control? So that was probably another big lesson that I learned is let them figure it out.
Yep.
You know, let them work through the controls. Mm-hmm. And if that means that they leave the control and they go to odor, I don't even wait for a response. Mm-hmm. I just mark that and then go back and shape that.
Yep.
That's right. That's right. Whereas the old way was like, no, they would work through the control, but then they didn't sit and then they get dragged out. And now I think about that and I go, oh, how did any dog pass?
I know, right?
Yeah.
No, it's a lot of things I go through. The other thing I thought that I loved watching you guys do is it's how you present odor now. You guys have multiple versions of your target odor.
Yeah.
You're not just doing your typical kit.
No.
You're getting other types of, you're getting the odor from, you know, like you said, stuff that's been seized, and how you go about hiding it, how you go about containing it, all the different variables that the odor is. And you guys get really good at that because at the end of the day, like we talked about, that's more important. If I don't have that, I don't have an indication anyway.
No, that's right.
So
if your dog can't find odor and you don't work on the multiple hides, but it's got a really good indication, it's not going to find anything to indicate on.
Mm-hmm.
That's how my mind changed in that. And it's still something that's in here to particular handlers because we were always fixated on that indication. I mean, I was taught that.
Yep.
Getting them out of them and saying to them, you know, shaping and marking is about taking percentages. Like the dog doesn't have to be 100% right to be rewarded. Mm-hmm. It might come in and indicate and give you a half sit.
Yeah.
Take that, send it back and ask for 100%. So I guess when we start talking to them about what percentage are you going to take? So when I bring them into training, I'm like, this dog hasn't had this odor in this hide before. So how about if you get a standoff, you just take that. Why do we have to wait for the sit?
Exactly.
You know,
there's a variable that changed in that confusion. We don't know in that moment what's the dog confused about. And if we keep waiting out for something that we expected, we may miss the mark of at least the dog knew the odor.
Yes.
And that was the most important part.
That's right.
And like you said, we can refine why it didn't give the typical trained response, but it did acknowledge the odor. And that's the most important critical part we want.
That's right. And you can get 5 rewards on the same thing by just sending them back to shape that.
Mm-hmm.
So now they've had 5 photos taken in their brain rather than the one. The other one they get that we've moved away from and fixated on is when odor's high, because I find with marking, we're asking them to put their nose on point. But then all of a sudden we say to them, but we want a sit response, which takes your nose away from odor. So when our hides are high, a lot of our marker trained dogs will go up high and hold their nose on it. And the handler goes, but I want it to sit. I'm like, so you want it to move away from odor? And they look at me and I go, well, which one do you want?
Yeah.
Do you want it to be close? Do you want it not to? So I think once I start asking them those questions of becoming fixated on a final response, a lot of the handlers around here will, the new ones will go, don't care. The old ones will go, oh, I kind of see what you're talking about. And then you just, as soon as you bring out that, what percentage are you taking? And they look at you and they go, I'd probably take 50. Then they start to change their mindset. But it's educating them. I guess the other thing that we find that we do more now, which I didn't get, is as a handler, I wasn't taught how to set up training.
Yeah.
It was bang, you're a handler on the road, see you later. We've set up, so the instructor set my training up. They did all my controls. They did all the odor. I as a handler didn't even know that if my dog found 1 gram, that wasn't going to find 100 grams without being trained, or a kilo. No one taught me that. I've learned that over time. So that if I went out as a handler on the road without even knowing that advice, then what hope did I have? You know, so we have started to bring in with our training on our course in the last 2 weeks, we step out and we say, your dog's done all the odors now. What are you going to do for the last 2 weeks? Or we give them scenarios of things that we already want to set up. And we say to them, this is your training today. What do you think your dog needs? So we start in the last 2 weeks making them go out to the property points, them get the different types of drugs. They set up their hides, they source the venues, we give them a list and we're like, what venue are you going? What drugs are you doing? Mm. And then their faces change. I go, in the last 2 weeks, you guys will be running this show. And they're like, no, we aren't. And I'm like, no, you are, because I'm not going to be there on the road at a search warrant when you find meth and your dog doesn't indicate. I'm not going to be next to you to show you how to train the dog to do that. Are you going to go back to tubes? Are you going to do an LSR? We call them live seizure runs. Yes.
Okay.
Are you going to train in situ?
Mm-hmm.
Did your dog give you a change on that? You know, and educating them. You don't just say yes.
Yeah.
If dog doesn't give you a change. So it's about setting them up in those scenarios. And then we try and go out to a few warrants with them to have a look at how their dog's going, especially the brand new handlers, because their face just melts down when their first dog doesn't hit a hide, but every other dog does. And then they think that they're broken. So it's about teaching them, no, you're not broken. Mm-hmm. It's street gear, you know, and guiding them through that. Whereas I was a dog on the road driving 12 hours by myself without even knowing about odor permeation times. So that's another big thing that we changed.
And it's really cool because you guys, by doing that, they're able to help each other when because you said there's multiple handlers working.
Yeah.
So when they partner up and they're not able, somebody can set up a hide or set up a training scenario, whether it's a hide or not a hide, they're able to set up something for each other. They're not, it's no longer really the blind leading the blind.
No,
they actually have a level of understanding and they can, you know, conduct, you know, really beneficial training and get stuff done when they don't see you guys for a few weeks.
That's right. And I think that's where you guys brought a lot to them this week was to show them how to progress. Don't get stale. Don't take the dog that Jay, Pat and Mark have done for you and think that you're a rock star, because on the road you're going to hit all these issues that you haven't hit before, and we're not there to help you to fix them. And it's your responsibility to make your dog get better. It's about if we can tell how much work a handler's done when they come into the room with us, and each of them, you know, to their own, and how much time they have, experiences, all different circumstances to what they do. Mm-hmm. So we can always tell what they've been up to.
And the last thing I love is you guys incorporate technology into your training. I had never come to a unit where I saw so many GoPros being used. And you guys use your Axion cameras, the ones that you guys have on the road, and you link it to your iPads that you guys have, and you're able to actually sit back and watch the teams run from a distance and not even have to be there with them. And then like we did yesterday, when we got done at the end of the day, we all sat and watched every handler run through their training and got to debrief how we saw it happen and talk to the handler. What were you thinking at this point in time? What did you do here? And why did you do that? And had some good feedback.
It was interesting because our old assessments used to be set it up. The handler would come in, the dog would indicate, they'd look at the trainer and we'd go yes or no. Well, we stopped doing that. And the first year we sent our handlers in and we were like, we're going to put GoPro on you. One of us will be in the room. they don't know where it is. So don't look at us for help. And they're mm-hmm. like, yeah, but how do I know to reward my dog? And I was like, well, how do you know on the road? So now we set up as our training and I go, your training is we're two detectives. We would like you to clear this warehouse, please. So I start putting scenario training into place. And that's why I try to keep operational and try and keep asking the guys, what are they seeing? What are we doing? Because you need to be able to do it yourself. So when I change the context of assessments versus scenarios of don't ask the two detectives out the front when your dog indicates should you reward.
Exactly.
They aren't going to be able to tell you. So once we changed and put it that way for them, they started to change how they came to assessments. And those, it was interesting, you know, those that trusted their dogs, I would say that last year, the ones that we did, 80% of the handlers, it was a big warehouse and we got them to work in teams as well because they do that a lot on the road. So it was a big warehouse. Some of them got two dogs. I'm like, these two handlers are working together. I don't care how you do it. Clear it just like you would on the road.
Mm-hmm.
And those handlers that trusted their dog and did the training, I'd say 80% of them rewarded unknown and found all of them off lead away from their dogs and trusted their dogs in that process of it as well. So for us as trainers, it was good to see
yeah.
because one of the biggest things that when I started saying reward blind, you don't know what's there. That was just never heard of.
Yeah.
We used to praise them off and move them on. I was like, mm-hmm. well, praise is a form of reward. So yeah. you're either pregnant or not pregnant.
Pregnant, yeah.
I love it. So, yeah, we started to say that to them. Well, either – and then we changed – this is an Australian thing. I don't know if you guys mm-hmm. have heard of it, praising off.
Yeah, so that is a big thing in the United States. They would do this praise off all the time, and then the dog just kind of learned, well, in this situation, I'm only getting this. And in some dogs, that's not – it only brings up their frustration. So they would see these other behaviors come out because a dog really wanted, hey, I found the thing.
Moving
give me
away,
my,
yeah. shuffling. So we moved away from that 2 years ago. And like markers, we train our dogs to have okay release.
Mm-hmm.
So where we found, because we were finding a lot of praise off, so it used to sort of get to us, I'd be like, well, what about if the dog is sitting on a control and you're going, good boy, good boy. Like so now we've started teaching them from puppies when we release them out of the back of the car. So we use obviously the yes marker, good marker for duration, and the okay marker means you've done mm-hmm. the right thing. You're yep. not getting paid right down. You might yep. have done the right thing yep. or not the wrong thing.
Yep.
You found it, but I want you to work on and move to the next thing. And we start that on puppy tubes. So we get one odor in this tube and then mm-hmm. a few blank ones and then an odor over here. Mm-hmm. Once the dogs are steady on odor, and then the first time we do it on lead.
Yep.
The first time, same thing. So dog hits odor, we say okay, and then the dog's like, oh, I've heard that word before, and we put them onto the next tube, and then they find it, then we mark it. So we start it in our training environment,
yep.
and then that works really nicely for our dog. So we say to the handler, well, if you don't know, what do you say? Okay, like just release the mm-hmm. dog rather than – so now I think I've given them that safety net in their brain where they're not rewarding
mm-hmm.
and they've got the option, you know, especially the older handlers
yep.
where you never reward blind
yep.
is now they've got that little bit of a safety marker that says, well, I'm not really rewarding. I'm like, well, you're not rewarding. You're just asking the dog to move on for now, and it probably was. And because, you know, in your assessments, we can't have them opening everything up, even though some of them want to find things, because other people have got to come through, you know. So I found that moving from the praise off stopped our dogs from moving away from stims. Our false indications dropped
yep.
because we weren't praising them on gloves and things like that.
Yep.
And then we also weren't saying no and marking them and removing them
correct.
And making the decision for them. Mm-hmm. So the okay release marker
yep.
has worked well. But, yeah, we moved yeah. away from praise offs about 2 years ago for that reason. Even we did have it for a while with marker-trained dogs
yep.
when we're using the yes marker and we still were praising off. But we just started seeing all these issues that we were like, that doesn't really – it doesn't really match, like just release them
yep.
and teach them.
And that matches really close to what the Austrians were doing
yeah.
with the middle command.
Yes.
So the dog's on, could be searching, could be on something, they're not sure. Just call the dog
back.
To the middle.
Yeah.
They say middle and it's release.
Yeah.
The dog comes to this position.
Yeah.
And then they can decide, what do I want to do? Continue searching.
Or
maybe I can reward. Maybe because yeah. we're just done.
Yeah.
Whatever the option was.
And the rewarding for a good search.
Exactly.
That was probably one of the hardest things that I had to bring in. We do the same thing. We do a search even on the wall or wherever. And then we to make handlers feel more comfortable with it, we say, take your dog outside, call him back, come. Take him out the door and have a game with your dog. Run him back to the car, big game, just for in some handlers. Fixated on the harness not being on. I'm like, I don't care.
Yeah.
just praise your dog mm-hmm. because he just searched for 7 minutes and didn't give you a false indication mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And take the dog outside. So I found in the last 5 years moving over to the okay release marker, rewarding for a good search and not correcting them for controls, mm-hmm. We've seen a decline in false responses by at least 75%. We yeah. still get them.
Of course,
but not animals. Every course 20 times a day because we're putting controls out and the dogs
are confusion, et cetera.
Exactly. Yeah. So we sure. found that was a big, I can't remember where we got that from. It was yeah. somebody that I watched somewhere, but having you good guys training. Say the same thing, you saw Pat and I nodding at the back of the classroom, like, yeah, good. They do it too. Yeah. Cause some people still think we're idiots.
Sure.
You know, some people don't agree with it. Mm-hmm. We just go with what works.
Yeah.
Like for now.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for taking the time for doing this.
No.
This information will be great for a lot of people. Mm. I know they're going to have a lot of takeaways. I know you've been sitting back, you know, loving this too.
Yeah.
So again, thank you so much.
No, thank you.
I really look forward to it. And like I always tell everybody, you know, keep tuning into what we share. And it's my little joke is it's always okay to be nosy.
Yeah, no. And thank you guys. Like I said, you guys were awesome. It's really funny. Sometimes I can tell them things, but you know, for having other people come in, and speak to them, you definitely changed. There were heads that were nodding that I never thought would nod and agree. So, it's nice to have you guys come in and share your knowledge and help us out heaps. So thank you.
Thank you.